for the Mysterious Universe, Season 33, Episode 6. Coming up on the show, we've got Falling into the Pocket Dimension, Spirited Away in Russia, and Playing Chicken with the Spanish Shapeshifters. I'm your host, Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
Nice recovery there. Well done.
The S's in the intro.
I could tell that was well done. I've got stories coming out of Russia too.
That was weird how we synced up yesterday.
I know.
Because at the end of the day, I said, all right, what have you been working on? You said, oh, just Russian alternate dimension stories. I said, that's what I've got. That's exactly what I've been doing.
I hope we weren't reading the same book or going through the same stories.
No, it's different books.
Yeah. Okay.
Perfect. But I'm going into, where is it? It's not going to win any awards. It's Encounters of Parallel Worlds.
What are you talking about? That cover is just schmick.
It's by Alexa Prevednik. And it's just full of, 70 true stories of these so-called ventures into, glitches in the Matrix, parallel dimensions. But what made it interesting is they're all Russian stories.
Right, yeah.
And a lot of them we haven't heard before, but we see the same patterns. But because it was a Russian-themed collection of stories, I then went into Lilia Sarajeva's Voyages Through Time and Space.
Oh.
With a painted nude Russian woman on the cover. How could I resist?
A Russian psychic.
How could I resist? And one of the things that happens to her is, remember a couple of weeks ago you spoke about a friend of yours here mm-hmm. who had, I don't want to say what he had, but he had a problem with his knee. And after... was it a substance? Did he take a substance? He ventured,
he ventured
into his
side. Yeah.
He went into his knee.
He took substances which are not entirely prescribed, I suppose.
Right.
Here is a way to describe it. And because he's been struggling with a knee injury that he's had for years, because he played a lot of football when he was young. And he's had, alternative therapies and, acupuncture, God knows what. But he's doing really well because he took these substances and went into his knee and then spoke to like an entity that I don't know if it was healing him or if it was the entity that was responsible. I don't know exactly. I didn't get the full details. But yeah, like he went into his knee and saw how to heal it.
That's what happened to this Russian woman.
Are you kidding me?
She didn't go into her knee. She goes into her bloodstream.
Oh.
She said it was very claustrophobic.
Who was the woman that did something very similar? How she was able to, was it Rosemary?
Vera Adler's the original one.
Oh, was it her? Yeah, she went in and she was able to see like the structure of her cells. Like that,
she had a conversation with like a white blood cell or something.
That's right.
It was very rude.
Well, it's got a hard job. I mean, it's working pretty hard to protect your immune system and your body, so I understand that.
So you got Russian stuff coming up as well?
Not a lot, but this is actually going to be the theme of the show because we're going to be talking really what the theme of this entire show is, these anomalous zones and these, weird activities that take place, these supernatural areas. And funnily enough, the reason why this came to my attention is some rather sad news. It was because that Bering Air jet plunged from the sky earlier last week. I think it was Thursday, where a jet carrying, it says here, 10 people in the skies over Alaska plunged to the ground on Thursday, with all 10 on board likely to have died, with 3 bodies being recovered so far. This is a very, horrible story. But the reason why it's doing the circle at the moment within the paranormal sphere, is because it crashed in the Alaskan Triangle.
Oh, yes. So the old Alaskan Triangle.
The good old Alaskan Triangle. So
there it is.
This is the area of where, and I'm going to get into it, but there's a lot of strange occurrences in this location.
Isn't it a triangle because there's only 3 places in Alaska?
Yes, I believe that's exactly why. No, it goes from Juneau to Anchorage to Barrow and back, obviously. But one thing that really got my attention with this, fits in with what we've been talking about a lot recently, is these anomalous zones, these areas of where, I was talking about it in the sense of telluric currents and ley lines and these sacred sites. But the reality is, I think people that are not totally informed on this kind of stuff tend to think that these are very hard defined boundaries in these areas. You've got the Bermuda Triangle, you obviously have the Alaskan Triangle, you have the M Triangle in Russia, which is a location we'll be going to later on. You also have the Bass Strait Triangle. So the Bass Strait is an area of water that is between Melbourne and Tasmania, or, it's basically at the bottom of Australia. But in that particular location, there's been a lot of strange occurrences, including the disappearance of the pilot Valentich, which is a story that, if you're listening to this, you're probably very well aware of that. But these lines that people draw on maps are not as well defined as people think. And of course, if anomalous zones are being generated by whether it's some type of energy or a magnetic anomaly or something like that, like radio waves and other, you know, things that are intangible in that sense, they kind of move. They move about.
So it's not always a triangle.
It's not always. Sometimes it's a dodecahedron. Right. Sometimes it's, you know, perhaps a rhombus. You know, it's like, no, the thing about this is that these areas have strange phenomena attached to it, but a lot of stuff is dismissed from these areas. It's like, oh, no, it doesn't fall within the triangle. So I'm going to be telling you some of those stories as we get into it today.
We'll dive in.
Okay, we'll dive in. Okay, so let's jump into this particular area. We'll start with the Alaskan Triangle and we'll work our way back. But I wasn't aware of this. But since 1988, and I'm just going through all my notes here, since 1988, 16,000 people have gone missing from this particular triangle area, right? 16,000 people. That's a large number of people. And you go, well, you know, like, is that standard? Like, if you were to just arbitrarily draw a triangle anywhere on a landmass in the world, would you find that there'd be a considerable number of people, you know, up to that level disappearing?
That's a pretty big triangle.
It's a big triangle.
But Alaska's sparsely populated.
That's right. Alaska is sparsely populated. But the other thing as well is that this particular area, it's rugged. Like, it is rugged terrain where it's actually not surprising that people would disappear because people go hiking, they go hunting, they go camping, they go into these locations. And a lot of people, sadly enough, are either too arrogant about their capabilities and are not prepared correctly, and, you know, that's why they disappear in this, or perhaps they're just naive about the dangers that are there. But for some reason, let's look at some of the disappearances, right? So according to, and I think it's like the National People's Registrar of Missing Persons, something similar to that. If you look at their stats, you find that you've got places like, I think, let's talk about Hawaii. Hawaii is one particular location that seems to have a higher incidence of disappearances. I don't know why, because Hawaii is a rather small landmass. It's not, I mean, yeah, it's also could be considered to be remote and you could have, you know, rugged landscapes, especially on places like the Big Island. But I think the disappearance rate there is somewhere in the realm of like 16% or 16 out of 100, not 16%, I'm sorry, that's way too high. It's 16 out of 100,000 people. So that was like I think 2023 was the last report on that. And then you have Oregon, for example. I think that has a disappearance rate that is kind of in the same range. It's like in the low 16s out of 100,000 people. So that's pretty strange. But if you look into Alaska, it's in the range of about 170 people per 100,000 people that go disappearing. Yeah, 170.
So what was the stat you gave of missing people? 16,000.
No, 16 out of 100,000. So when you look
but
at the
total missing people you mentioned earlier.
Oh, yes, you're right. Sorry, 16,000 people since 1988 have disappeared. And according to the most recent reports, it's 2,000 people a year disappear in this region. Why? Why would 2,000? You've got plenty of locations around the world that have rough terrain and weird weather and all that kind of stuff. Why are people disappearing so
much? Harsh climate. So if you go missing in other places, you're not going to immediately die of exposure. In Alaska, you may. Lifestyle factors as well, they're putting in there.
Why would they put in lifestyle factors?
Because a lot of people are fat and unfit. And so you have trouble if you're fat and unfit, you've got less chance of getting back to civilization.
Yeah, but are fat and unfit people deliberately going out into the wilderness? I don't think so.
I don't know. I'm just asking GPT. And the geography and terrain, obviously, the vast wilderness and there's not much services there.
That's the big factor, right? But there is this history of, and why it kind of starts fitting into a more supernatural or perhaps paranormal sense is because scientists have looked into this particular area. Because, and just like not necessarily because of they're looking for some paranormal triangle, they're just trying to obviously conduct geological surveys and coincidentally they found unusual events. They found that there are strange magnetic anomalies all throughout this region. Very strange magnetic anomalies, much like what is being reported anecdotally, of course, coming out of the Bermuda Triangle. Is this like what Ivan Sanderson described? He described the vile vortices. These are areas of energy production all throughout the world that create strange problems. He said there's even, I think it was like the 30th parallel seems to follow that line. And that 30th parallel has things on it like the pyramids. Like, is it that ancient people understood these energies and that's why they put particular landmarks on them? Perhaps people argue that the pyramids themselves were used by ancient people as some type of weird power plant. Like, there's those stories that are out there which we've covered. But then we come back to the Alaskan Triangle, and there's just a little bit more to it. So could it be that these magnetic anomalies are causing planes to disappear only because it's interfering with their electrical equipment. Like, it's rather mundane. It's a natural phenomenon.
Wait, are planes disappearing or just crashing?
No, planes do disappear. Planes disappear. So we go back to one of the earliest reports, January 1950. You've got a Douglas C-54 Skymaster. This took off from the Elmendorf Air Force Base, headed to Montana. As it passed into the Yukon Territory, the Air Force lost radio contact with it. Both the US and Canadian military scoured this area with up to 7,000 personnel. It's 350,000 square miles of search, and they couldn't find a thing. Nothing. This thing never showed up. Now, that's not to say that it disappeared into another dimension. Like, it could have just crashed in extremely rugged terrain. But 7,000 personnel? And the kicker to this is, right, you can go, okay, this is a reasonably large plane. Like, you think if it crashed even in a snowstorm, eventually you'd be able to see it. Someone would find it.
Yeah, but in some airplane crashes, there's not much left. They're pretty catastrophic.
That's true. That is true. 2 weeks later, a much smaller plane went down in the same region, and they were able to find it immediately. Immediately. So it's like, okay, if you become a little bit more, you know, leaning towards the paranormal side of things, and this is an anomalous zone, it has, you know, weird activity, electromagnetic activity going on, is this place a gateway? Is it allowed? Did it get sucked into another dimension? And of course, that's some of the arguments that are being put forward by numerous researchers into this area, is that this particular location, like other locations around the world, is a doorway. It's a gateway. That's why people are disappearing. And if you start looking into the folklore, and this is why it's important not to dismiss folklore as just being a silly superstition, you have the inhabitants, the local inhabitants who have been there for a long time saying, yeah, there are entities. These entities can disappear, can appear. They come out from parallel worlds. I don't even necessarily call them parallel worlds, but that's the, in a nutshell, what they are describing. And these things prey on human beings.
They're still looking for that plane, by the way. I just looked it up. That
there you go, 1950.
DC-54.
75 years ago, they're still looking for
They're using drones as of 2022. They're using drones to try and find it.
Are they gonna find it? Then you've got the disappearance of a search and rescue operator. So this was Gary DeBerry. He disappeared in 2011. And this kind of sets up, you know, it's could be, I guess, like a use case for many of these disappearances, even though it's very seldom that you have a search and rescue person disappear. But it's that it's in such a strange circumstance in the sense that he was on a search outside of Fairbanks. He'd taken off in an ATV. And he just never came back. No one knows what happened to him. They sent canines out to find him. The dogs behaved in a strange fashion. They weren't able to find a scent. They seemed to be confused. They brought in professional trackers. They couldn't find any tracks, which is odd because you should be able to find something. These professional trackers are really good with their job. They know what they're doing. They couldn't find anything. Eventually, a year later, they found the ATV just sitting there. It's like the engine had been switched off. It's
any
like
fuel?
Fuel in it. He'd just switched it off. And disappeared.
Just had enough. I felt like that sometimes. Just want to get on my ATV and ride off into the snow.
I mean, normally I describe it as just walking into the ocean, but perhaps he walked into a bank of snow. Like, that's what he did. But I'm setting up all of these stories. I'm giving you these stories before we get into it from a few anecdotal stories as to people that may have seen what this is. They've managed to come back from these strange experiences, whereas these people simply haven't. And the number of people that go missing in Alaska every year is twice as high as the national average. So that's important. And this is something, and I'll link to, there's like a unexplained episode or something from the History Channel, which I'll link to, so you can go and check it out yourself. It's got people like David Politis and who, you know, focuses on missing 411 and these strange disappearances. Even he, who would really be considered to be, you know, an expert in this field, he's like, there's something very strange going on in the Alaskan Triangle. Very, very strange. This is not just simply, you know, AI generated, well, this is the answer as to why. No, it's more than that. You've got Professor Tok Thompson, who's a professor of anthropology. He talks about the Kenai Peninsula. He said this is the southern part of it, at least. There's a town there that was called Port Lock, and this was an extremely successful cannery town. But for some reason, it was abandoned by 1950. 1950, everyone had left, and it was because it was being terrorized, allegedly, by a monster. The local people identified it as a manita, which is a Bigfoot-style creature. But this thing was coming into town and attacking people, allegedly killing people. But also some people were reporting that these beings were taking people into other realms. That's the term that was used. Like, other realms? You can see how it's setting up this scene of like, that's maybe that's why so many people just simply disappear. And when I say disappear, it's not like they disappear and you find their body frozen in the snow a couple of years later. No, they just disappear without any trace. And like missing 411 cases, sometimes, rarely, but you will find things like folded clothing.
Mm.
Or there was one particular story of a woman who disappeared, but when she disappeared, they found this path. And so they were able to track her. And as they walked along this path, and when it wasn't like a defined path, it was the path of where she had walked, but they were walking along, she'd discarded clothing. It's like she'd thrown off a jacket, then she'd thrown off a top, then she'd thrown off underwear. It's like, but in this weird fashion, and then the tracks just stopped. Like, just stopped. How is it? And the argument
with
that.
Yeah, the track stopping is weird. I mean, most people would say the clothes is the hypothermia thing.
That's right. Exactly what I was going to say. People claim that it's hypothermia and for whatever reason, but you're already in this cold climate. But to strip off like that, I know it causes you to become disoriented, but wouldn't you just keel over in the snow? Or wouldn't you just keel over on that terrain? You would leave some type of trace. Even if wild animals came and consumed you.
There would be traces.
There would be something. It wouldn't be this weird kind of almost uniformity to it. In many of these cases, it's like, what is happening to these people? It seems like there's definitely something more unnatural or unusual taking place. And, you know, the stories of local folklore really do highlight this, that there are strange creatures that just simply materialize out of thin air and then disappear as rapidly. So what are these creatures doing? Do they know about us and they're just coming along because it is a remote region snatching us?
To be fair though, if you went missing there in that region, the picture I've put up on the screen here, how are you ever going to find me?
I'm probably not. But you know what? I think but this is the thing though. You're right. But 16,000 people since 1988, 2,000 people a year, surely you would find, you know, a considerable percentage of those people.
Well, is it also because the regions are so remote? Like if someone goes missing in a state that's more populated with more resources, you have more searches. You have a larger search party. You have more resources to spend on the search. Whereas in Alaska, where it's hard to get a large group of people together to do the search, it's just less likely. You're just less likely to find someone.
I definitely think that plays a part in this. But there is still more to it, though. I mean, yeah, this particular area is apparently almost the size of California. Mm. Like, it is an enormous space. And you're right, because it's so vastly populated and perhaps resources are reduced and people are flying over it. It's not like you're, pardon me, sending out, you know, crews that can just kind of easily wander through these places. Some of these places really are treacherous. Maybe that explains it. But then there's these other stories that come up that go, maybe there's more to it. Another example is from 1995. You have Erin Gilbert. She was a student. She was on a date at a local fair, and she had a great time at the fair, apparently, and she was being driven home by her boyfriend. And as they're driving along, funnily enough, I mean, this could be completely coincidental. There's nothing to it. But this area with these magnetic anomalies, apparently it plays extreme havoc with guidance systems, compasses, and electronic equipment. People claim that their batteries and power sources are rapidly drained when moving into these particular areas. So in 1995 with Erin, she's driving home one evening and her boyfriend's driving. The battery just stops. Apparently the car comes to a halt. The battery's completely drained. He doesn't know what to do, but he knows that there's help not too far away. So he says, stay here. He climbs out, goes for a wander. Guess what? When he comes back, she's just gone. Disappear. She's never been found. Never. Now, look.
Still a reward to find her, by the way.
Is there really? Yeah. So, look, there could be people out there that there could be, you know, deranged murderers and stalkers and all that kind of stuff. But that many people in these odd circumstances, that to be no tracks, nothing else, there is this kind of, it's not funny, but it fits in with a modern trope. So, you've got Congressman Nick Bagger. And also Hale Boggs. Is Hale Boggs? Beggs? In 1972, they were in a plane that was heading from Anchorage to Juneau. There was low visibility and bad weather. The pilot had, you know, a whole heap of experience and training. You know, it wasn't like these guys were being flown by someone who was inexperienced. The plane just disappeared. Like, it just disappeared. And they conducted, I think it was a 40-day search, you know, again, 325,000 square miles, and they found nothing. Like, they found nothing at all. So, I mean, Hale was the House Majority Leader. But this caused a huge stir, a huge political stir, right? Nothing has ever been found of them. Now, the story goes, right, that the staffer who drove Hale to the airport in the first place in Washington, D.C. to get his flight to go was a young Bill Clinton.
Are you serious?
I'm serious. And apparently, I was looking into it, apparently there was a power struggle that was going on with Hale at the time. And I'm like, look, I don't think Bill Clinton had any serious power back then, but...
I did not sabotage that plane.
It just fit with the... I mean, was Hillary even on the scene at that point? It's just, it's all a little bit strange, but we'll leave that for another day. Then, of course, you have got this other weird thing as well, where missing 411 style, right? There's the, some of the most odd missing 411 cases is where there is a large group of people and a singular person disappears in front of all those people.
Yeah, they're either in the middle of the pack and there's a slight gap and then they're gone.
And they're gone.
Or they're there at the end. Yeah. It's usually they're at the end or they get left behind for some reason and when they come back, they're gone.
That's right. This happened in 2012. There was a 66-year-old man. His name was Michael Lemaitre. He was going on the Mount Marathon race. Now, this is, again, this is an example. This is all the way down on the outer edge of the triangle, just on the outskirts. But again, you know, highlighting the fact that if this is some type of magnetic anomaly, which is generating a dimensional rift, of course it's going to move. You're going to have these weird, and guess what else? It's a mountain. Mountains in folkloric tales, many folkloric tales themselves are associated with the disappearance of, or you know, energy. The people just will disappear into energy wells and all this kind of stuff. So with his case, 2012, he goes on this annual run. So basically, it's like if you've ever been on a marathon, they go off in waves. The first wave of, you know, more fit people had taken off. The second wave was going. He was part of the second wave, and he left at 3:15. Now, when he took off, the average finishing time, I think, is like an hour and a half for people to get all the way up to the top of the hill and come back down. And he was gone for much longer. Now, it was around 2:30, I believe. No, 2.5 hours later, I'm sorry. It was 2.5 hours later when they had the race officials that were just checking, like going up the mountain to see where everyone was. They'd gone to the top of the mountain and were coming back down. And they encountered Michael, who was still struggling up the hill. And he's like, no, 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 I'm going to finish this. I'm going to finish. It was only 200 feet or something from the summit of this hill. And they're like, okay, yeah, fine, no worries. It gets to 5:48. The guy never comes down. He just disappeared. This is where there were hundreds, if not 1,000 people that were climbing up and down this mountain. These officials were there. They saw him. He just simply disappeared.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the Anchorage Daily News article from 2021, and they had a quote from Christopher Solomon, the Runner's World journalist, who said, "The mountain swallowed this man."
Yeah.
And
how is that even
his
possible?
Wife sued the race for $5 million.
How is it the race's fault?
Yeah. What $5 million? That's absurd. She ended up settling for 25 grand.
Yeah. But I mean, it's not the race's responsibility. This is the thing. The guy, you know, he was chair. I mean, also good on him for 66 years old going and doing that. But also, if he'd had a heart attack or something, you would have found his body. They found nothing. Then you have Lake Iliama. I'm sorry if I mispronounced that, but this is Alaska's largest lake. 2013, so a year later after this particular event, you've got Rick Nelson. Now, Rick Nelson took his kayak out, as many people do, like a completely normal thing to do, goes kayaking. 4 days later, people come across his kayak. It's upside down on the lake, which is not an unusual thing to do. It's like on the shore. And apparently people, to keep obviously rain out, would turn it upside down. With all of his personal belongings neatly inside, the guy just disappeared. Gone. But just gone. How is that even possible?
What's this guy's name again?
This guy was named Rick Nelson. So he just gone, right? Again, just slightly outside of this zone. And yeah, it's a lake, but I would get it if his kayak had sunk and he disappeared into the water, but that doesn't seem to be the case. And why would you neatly put your belongings into an upside down kayak so they're protected from the weather and just wander off? Just wander into the lake. There doesn't seem to be any history of him trying to escape anything. He wasn't in financial difficulty. It's very unusual. Then we have to go back to something a little bit earlier.
Was a case from November 2024, similar case, but they found the guy. He tried to fake his own death.
And that's the thing. Yeah, I'm sure that there will be people that would attempt to do those things. Did he actually manage to... Obviously, he didn't manage to get away with it because they found him, right?
Yeah, they found November 2024 led to an extensive search. The individual faked his own disappearance. He eventually revealed to investigators the methods he used to stage the incident, which was involving a canoe. like leaving a canoe.
Yeah, right.
Just look, like that story.
We can't, this is the thing as well, we can't rule out these particular cases that that's not happening, right? Maybe people do attempt to, because again, and they may not have any knowledge about the paranormal stories coming out of this area.
Oh, he's an idiot.
Why?
He sent a text message or something to his wife that said, "I'm safe and secure. No problem. I hope this works."
You dumbass. There was an Alaskan missionary by the name of Chuck Crepshue, I think, 1967. He was flying over the same lake. He claims he saw a plesiosaur.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like, okay.
That it's all making sense.
Now we're crossing into this kind of thing. So is it possible that Rick Nelson, yeah, he could have faked his death and he could have just simply disappeared, or was he taken by one of these creatures? Like, is that what occurred? So talking about the folkloric tales of this area and the legends, we come to this story from 2007. This is from Diana Tucker. Now, she was in the southeastern area of this triangle. She'd gone out with her husband and some friends. I don't know how many it was, but they were heading through Frederick Sound. They were just on across, I believe, from, I think it's an area called Peterson. So they were just across from Peterson. And as they'd been, you know, going out just for a day's boating and whatever it was, they decided to pull into this particular area where there was a beach and some woods. And they thought that they would go and have a picnic lunch because they didn't want to do it on the boat. And of course, yeah, that's completely normal. So Diane and a friend, I think her friend's name was Betsy, they climb out, they wander out. And while their husbands and friends are setting up, you know, a picnic essentially, they're like, oh, let's go for a wander. Let's go and take some photographs. So they go and, you know, kind of wander through. And this is where it becomes kind of strange and it fits into this idea of the pocket dimensions. So she goes for a wander with Betsy. She becomes separated at some point where she finds that there's a trail of some kind. There's this weird kind of trail. And she starts wandering into the trail. And as she wanders into the trail, she notices that there's a clearly defined barrier. There's like this area behind where it's beyond where she is. That is a clearing. And so it kind of seems appealing to her. So she wanders into this clear area. And she suddenly, almost like crossing into like a zone, passing through the veil, Oz factor, like Oz effect. Everything goes deathly silent, like everything silent.
No birds, no insects, nothing.
No wind. It was a normal summer's day, like all those noises that are around, like it becomes conspicuous, right? Yeah, you can walk into an area which is quiet, but it's like when you walk into an area that is conspicuously quiet, it triggers you, like it has this jarring effect. And funnily enough, the folkloric legends around this area is that these entities, these interdimensional entities, if you will, they know how to tap into your mind. They know how to read what's going on in your mind. Much like, in fact, what Von Brashler was talking about in the last episode when we were talking about how Von himself was learning about, you know, the dangers of clearing out haunted houses. One thing that he pointed out in that particular piece that he was writing was that some entities are able to tap into what's in your mind. And what they will do, these ghostly entities he was referring to, but it could apply to a wide spectrum of these things, these non-human entities, is that they're able to represent, you know, like a loved one. So they'll appear as a passed over grandmother or something like that to create this comfort with you. But it's for their nefarious purposes. Well, these entities, according to local folklore, do exactly the same thing, but they're able to tap into the most immense fear that you have. And we come back to Diana, who, when she was a child, her brothers showed her The Birds by Alfred Hitchcock, right? Which to us today, we're all so desensitized to violence. I'd be like, it's a bunch of birds. Like, as long as there's a phone booth around, I'll be okay. Although it's saying that with cell phones now, maybe not. But she was terrified by it as a child. She was absolutely terrified.
Traumatized,
like completely traumatized. So she wanders into this zone. And as soon as she wanders into this zone, there are all these crows, like all these black birds, but hundreds of them just sitting all on the trees around her. And she's like, oh, this is, and she's obviously feeling very distressed and uncomfortable. To where they swarm up into the sky. They fly up into the sky and then they attack her and they're pecking her and they're biting her and they're tearing flesh from her body. And she's rolling around screaming as she's being attacked by these birds. And she starts kind of army crawling and she pulls herself through. And once again, she goes back onto that path, right? The second that she crosses that path, it all stops and all the sound comes rushing back. And Betsy,
was she actually injured? Did she have flesh wounds or anything?
All she has is two scratches on her arm. Nothing else. But she'd gone from what she truly believed being torn apart by these birds, but she crossed that threshold and it abruptly stopped.
That's so interesting. There's a case from the Russian collection of stories where it's a young woman who goes to a train station and it's eerily quiet. I don't think there's any people around, maybe one or two people just exiting. And she says she saw this a couple of flying ants come through the fence on land on the platform. She's like, strange, I've never seen these flying ants ever in this area. And then more and more started to come. And then more started to come until it was an absurd swarm of these large flying ants to the point where they were all over her, completely covering her body. And she just thought, what on earth is going on? She started to brush them off and stomp them and, you know, crush them. And she was actually getting terrified that they were going to kill her or something.
Mm.
And eventually the train comes. She rushes onto the train, brushes off all the flying ants and thinks, that's insane. I've never seen that before. I've never seen these before. And that was just an incredible swarm. Now she gets to her location and she expects to read about this or hear it on the radio about this swarm of insects. And the afternoon, she goes back to that same station to go home, expecting to see like carcasses of dead insects everywhere.
Yeah, of course you would.
And there's nothing.
Nothing.
There's nothing there at all. She asks people at the platform and they say, what are you talking about? There was no ants. So it's very similar to what you described.
Did she have a fear of ants? I guess it's not described.
No, no fear of ants. She was attacked by a swarm of them. Got on the train when she went back to that station. There was no evidence that it happened.
That's very strange. See, in that particular story with Diana as well, is that she claims that she had an OBE while this was occurring. So she was up above her body watching as she was being attacked by these birds and running around.
It's very initiatory, very shamanic kind of experience.
Yes, it absolutely is. The kicker to this story as well is that she, as I pointed out earlier, she'd taken a camera with her. Like she wanted to take photos. She grabbed her camera as she'd walked and she accidentally hit the shutter. And later on, when she looked at the photograph, it was like 4 hours in the future.
Huh?
So there was like 4 hours that she'd been in this space, but somehow she wasn't. It was just truly surreal. But that is consistent with people going into other realms, into other spaces. It's like she was being attacked for 4 hours. You've also got a lot of UFO activity going on here. I'll link to that in the show notes. There was like a JAL cargo flight, I think it was 1623, It encountered two aircraft, unidentified aircraft in 1986, flying on its wingtips. It contacted the air traffic control. They said, we picked up nothing else on radar. And then after that, they saw an enormous craft about the size of a battleship or an aircraft carrier come up behind them as well that was pacing them for quite a long period of time through this particular area. And then it becomes even more exotic. Like there's a whole heap of strange things that are associated. Of course, you've got Pat Price claiming that, you know, when he was part of the CIA program with Project Stargate, that there was some underground alien base that was in Mount Haines, which happens to be
Yeah, that's right.
You know, happens to be kind of in the smack bang really in the middle of that triangle.
Let me look up my Pat Price notes actually. Because keep going.
The facility.
Yeah, because I'm wondering if there's anything very specific he said about that facility.
Yeah, look up Mount Hayes. You've also got then this report from 1992. Brent Swanser has got a great write-up on this, which I'll just link to so you can go read it for yourself. But there was this allegation that in 1992, the Chinese were conducting underground nuclear tests. And for whatever reason, a group of scientists were trying to monitor it through Alaska. I don't know why they were doing it there, but it doesn't matter. They were monitoring it through Alaska. Mm-hmm. And rather than picking up what was going on with the nuclear test, they actually picked up a structure, this large underground structure. Anecdotal reports suggest that it was a dark pyramid. And of course, military insiders have since come forward in these circles claiming that this thing is northeast of Denali. It's like 500 feet tall, but it's 700 feet underground. It's made of a polished black material. Some people have gone so far to be as bold as to suggest that it was an ancient power plant, much like what I described with the pyramids. One of the outlying stories, which is a little bit silly here, is that a man claimed that his father actually worked as a pilot flying into this area to supply the base that was there, that was connected to this dark pyramid. He saw the dark pyramid and no one believed him, right? So he built a scale model of it and then used it to power their farm.
So like, seriously, oh my God.
Take of that what you
yes,
will.
Yes, grain of salt, please.
Yeah.
So Pat Price, 1973, when he remote viewed Mount Hayes, he saw a launch area with metallic discs. He described a section filled with equipment, strange oscilloscope-looking machines. There's apparently a large black box on top of the peak that is concealed but contains some sort of antenna that he didn't recognize. But interestingly, he said that these people that are in this base that he remote viewed, he said they've infiltrated all the governments in sensitive positions, in positions of power, to stop politically any activity that may produce a result that could cause discovery.
Right.
So that's an interesting idea. They have people in place.
They're probably in the EPA saying, you can't build here. Yeah. The environment.
Not to shift politics in any, you know, really meaningful way, but anything to do with finding that base. That's their lobby, basically. They're also apparently responsible for strange activity and malfunctions on US and Soviet space projects. The source of it is this space.
Yeah, and you can see, so there's a history of high strangeness associated with this area. And perhaps this man was just simply being silly, but you've got 2020, you've got Nathan Campbell. And like, this is, I do not wish to speak ill of someone who was, you know, trying to look for truth, but I think it's extremely irresponsible as a father, right? So he's a father, family man. He hires a plane to fly him to Kerry Lake, which is northwest of Denali. Chatting to the pilot, he's like, yeah, I'm going to spend the summer looking for the Dark Pyramid, right? So just how many months is that? Like he's gone from, where is it in my notes here? He's gone from May until September. So on September the 15th, apparently the aircraft was supposed to meet him to collect him. He's nowhere to be seen. He stopped communicating with his wife in June. The guy just disappeared. They found his campsite, but nothing else. The guy has just disappeared off the face of the earth. When he went looking for an anecdotal story. Now, did he just, you know, as I pointed out earlier in the show, was he just naive and wasn't prepared for the conditions? Or was it that he went looking for something that he wasn't supposed to find?
I just want to show you the images that Pat Price, this is what Pat Price remote viewed inside the Alaska base. There's some kind of launch craft, looks like a rocket. There's that weird, see the boxes connected to this?
To the left here.
Yeah, there's boxes connected by a cable to this large kind of disc-shaped device.
His hand
looks like an eight gone.
So, yeah, eight gone. Extreme high frequency, like static? Is that what it's written?
This is a view from the Earth showing the peak and what it does, apparently. Is that a pyramid?
I don't know. A lot of it seems to be underground to those. What are those things saying? Is it erased? I can't tell from
here. Encased.
Oh, encased.
Something encased in the mountain. And the last one that he went into one of these facilities and there was like a Liberace looking alien playing a giant piano like device. Just jamming out. He claims as he flew in kind of out of body remote viewing this weird alien looking dude, he just turned around while he was jamming and just had this weird grin on his face like, looking at him.
Isn't that surreal?
Remote viewers, 100% accurate.
Yeah, well, but the only issue is, I mean, it was conducted by the CIA. I mean, it was a military sanctioned, essentially, operation. Like, they must be getting something. Like, we know that remote viewing does produce effects. Like, for example, they found those submarines, those Soviet submarines, which were supposed to be, from an engineering perspective, totally impossible to manufacture, and they found them.
Well, that's why the book from Skip Atwater was so interesting, because he was assigned to this project after Pat Price did all this remote viewing, and Skip Atwater was unknowingly assigned the same targets.
Right.
And he reported seeing the same things. What are the odds of that?
It's strange. Like, it's really, really strange. So look, let's move away from Alaska, though, because we want to talk about these particular zones. Brent has a great write-up on, and we're familiar with this. There's an old book that's been around for a little while now. It's called Mexico's Bizarre Zone of Silence, right? This is from Brent. And, you know, he highlights that, yeah, look, there are these anomalous places that are scattered all throughout the world, and they seem to elude any effort to be able to explain them. But then, of course, you've got a desert in northern Mexico, where this has been known as a wandering mystery zone because, much like the Alaskan Triangle, there seems to be these electromagnetic anomalies within it that create strange effects. So the zone of silence, the reason why it's known as the zone of silence, it's about 400 miles south of El Paso in Texas. It's just a desert zone. Like, it's just what would appear to be a normal desert zone. But apparently all forms of radio and TV signals completely fail to penetrate this area. It just doesn't work. It's almost unexplained. They cannot work out why radio signals and electromagnetic signals seem to just be impossible to move in this region. Now, locals have said that there's been something weird about this area for a long time. In fact, going back to the mid-19th century, farmers would complain of searing hot pebbles that would just rain down from the sky from time to time from nowhere. Just like poltergeist style, these things would happen. But apparently people say that this area, when you walk into it, induces this feeling of unease. And maybe that's because of the electromagnetic effects affecting people's minds somehow, like physically affecting them, but obviously producing this effect in their mind.
The official explanation is the mineral composition.
That's right. There's a huge amount of magnetite in this area. But is that magnetite, is that actually causing an induction effect on people's minds, or is it creating some type of dimensional rift?
Well, my favourite is that locals and visitors have reported encounters with tall, fair-skinned, blonde individuals who speak perfect Spanish but are described as not quite human.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. So for years, there have been various strange accounts from people passing through the region of all manner of high strangeness. One recurring story is that a trio of blonde-haired strangers are occasionally seen wandering the landscape. Allegedly, the trio is made up of two males and one female who are dressed in clothes that are totally inappropriate for a desert environment. Those who have met them.
Does that mean hot, sparkly spandex?
I don't
like
know.
Like the blue Pleiadian swimsuits.
I was wondering that. Like, they do have a Nordic feel to them, right? So people that have met them say they are very physically attractive, extremely polite, and speak perfect Spanish, like what you said, Ben. However, they also have a slight musical lilt to the way that they pronounce things.
Elves.
Maybe. The strangers are said to sometimes ask ranchers for water, but never food or anything else. And when they are asked where they are from, their simple response is, from above. That's all they say. So there was one scientist that there's this story of where, oddly enough, and perhaps it's like there's nothing to it at all, but there is this biosphere research station, which has been built out in the middle of nowhere. And this facility is a little bit strange where people claim that this trio of blonde humanoids have shown up. So there was this account that came from a journalist. So this journalist was Luis Ramirez Reyes. He was visiting the zone in November of 1978. He was part of a news team that was covering the mysteries of the area. And at their time, they were heading towards this biosphere research station when they got lost. They didn't know where they were. You know, it was obviously before, you know, readily available GPS, very isolated location. And they're driving around. Now, his photographer was the one who was driving the vehicle. And he's like, oh my God. Obviously, he starts thinking like, what if we run out of food? What if we run out of water? Like the gravity of this situation starts dawning on him and he's starting to become a little bit concerned when he looks out through the windshield and he sees this trio of figures just walking about. And he says to his photographer, he's like, slow down. We'll have a chat to them. The photographer drives straight past them. It's like, who are you talking about? There's no one there. He can't see them. But Lewis can. So after a while, they're traveling down the road. When they come across, now they've been driving for a while, right? And they haven't turned around unless they're being completely disoriented, but that doesn't seem to be the case. The same trio is now walking towards them.
Can the other guy see him now?
He can see them now, right? So he said, oh no, I'm sorry, no, he can't see them now.
Because they say you got to have extremely high T levels to see the Nordics.
No, I'm sorry, he can't see them, but he gets him to stop the vehicle. He implores him to stop the vehicle. He does. He gets out and he goes and speaks to this group, right? And this group, these three entities out in the middle of nowhere are clearly wearing clothes which are just totally odd for the environment.
So what is the driver seeing his passenger just gesticulating to the air? It's very Adamski, isn't it?
Oh, it is very Adamski.
Adamski had the same encounter out in the desert over a hill.
But it's enough because they give instructions on precisely where they can find the biosphere. So they clamber back into the vehicle and they drive off. They find it. But they just come around. Now, when they're speaking to the people at the biosphere, they're like, oh, yeah, we're so lucky that we really ran into these people. And the biosphere's like, what are you talking about? It's like, no, these three people,
people, they're wearing blue bikinis.
Yes.
There's long blonde hair, bright blue eyes, seven feet tall.
No one around for hundreds of miles. They're sure there is no one around for hundreds of miles. How is it that that they found them? No one knows. Then, of course, it seems like a lot has happened in the 1970s. You've got Josephine Diaz, who ventured into this area to collect fossils on October 13, 1975, traveling with other occupants in the vehicle as well. They were sifting through rocks when they noticed that there was a storm brewing on the horizon. aware of the dangers of flash floods in this area, they drove off but were soon caught in a deluge of rain. Now, because of the, you know, the way that this particular area works, the rain quickly generated mud and their vehicle got stuck. They didn't know how they were going to get out. When all of a sudden, two extremely tall men wearing odd yellow raincoats just suddenly appeared out of nowhere. The two strangers instructed the couple to get into the car and they will push. Now, they were unable to push the vehicle themselves. They tried very hard, but these two weirdos managed to just simply push the vehicle out of the mud, allowing them to drive off. He turns around and tries to hop out of the vehicle to thank them. There's no one there. But not only that, there's no footprints. There's no tracks. There's nothing left.
Did you have the campers report from 1995?
I don't believe so. What was that report?
A group of campers claimed they were visited bizarrely at night by, again, same description, two strange, tall, blonde individuals. The visitors were extremely curious and started asking them about human customs.
Weird.
Like, what are these things you're sleeping in? What is
that Borat phenomenon?
What is that device for drinking the fluid? What is the fluid? Like, asking all these ridiculous questions. The campers thought they were simply other travelers until the strangers vanished without making a sound or leaving footprints in the sand.
See, this is the weirdness about it. And these aren't people that are, I mean, because some people go, oh, well, they're dehydrated, so they'll hallucinate. I'm sorry, plenty of people become dehydrated. They don't hallucinate these identical figures or very similar figures. One that may potentially fit into that category, but he certainly wasn't dehydrated, was Ruben Lopez. So he was visiting a relative on the other side of this particular zone. As he was driving through, his vehicle started to experience difficulties and stalled. When it stalled, he noticed five small figures several feet tall by the side of the road. So they weren't the big ones. Like, he thought they were kids at first. But he looked and he realized that they were wearing these shiny silver outfits and helmets that opened in the front, revealing clearly adult faces rather than children. Now, these figures began approaching the truck where he got completely freaked out. Even though his vehicle had stalled, he was able to rev the engine. As soon as he revved the engine, these little weird beings kind of ran off. As soon as they ran off, the vehicle sprung to life once again and he was able to get the hell out of there. They were able to.
And all the eyewitnesses always know they're not tanned. They're not white.
No.
Tanned skin. They're incredibly pale. They stand out with how pale they are.
Yep. This area has also been a hotbed of UFO activity, of course, much like what's being reported in the Alaskan, anomalous zone. People have reported seeing weird orbs, pacing their vehicles. There was one reported in September of 1976 where an immense flying object hovered at the outskirts of town, which was estimated to be a staggering 300 meters in length, much like the Alaskan one. Like these extremely large UFOs.
Louis Ortega?
No, I'm not familiar with that.
So a farmer in a village near the zone reported seeing three tall figures standing beside his cornfield one afternoon. Mm-hmm. He initially mistook them for surveyors due to their unusual silver clothing.
There you go.
As he approached, they greeted him politely and asked about his irrigation practices. The conversation shifted to more abstract topics like water conservation and atmospheric changes. Ortega became uneasy when he realized the stranger's eyes seemed to be reflective, almost metallic. After answering their questions, he turned to walk back to his farmhouse, but when he glanced over his shoulder, they're gone.
Yeah. There's so many of these odd reports of people encountering these strange things. In fact, you've got Scott Corrales, which I'll link to in the show notes. He's got a full write-up on Strange Mag. It's this very, very old publication now, but describing many more of these encounters with these odd desert inhabitants, which seem to be able to phase in and out of reality. Who really knows what's going on? But this is also consistent with reports that come out of the M zone. This is an anomalous zone in Russia. It's the triangle of moles. So this is an extraordinary place. Although I think the translation that I'm going to link to, this comes from a Russian ufology website, but I sent you a truly stunning tale yesterday, Ben, that almost made me go, that's it, I'm done. I'm done for the day. Let me just bring it up for you. So this is where I was like,
Are you being facetious?
Oh, I was like, I was finished.
Is that like my story coming up where a hamster disappears and that's the end of the story?
No, you did send me one. What was the one you sent me yesterday? Story 17, a strange photo. There are plenty of strange incidents without even involving parallel worlds. I have a photo in my album that has been bothering me for years. In the picture, I'm standing with my shift engineer in front of the Egyptian pyramids. But here's the catch. Our research vessel never docked in Egypt.
And of course, there's no photo.
There's no other information.
Nothing. So for
what
me,
a banger.
For me, the banger, and they're like everything that I despise about this phenomenon just seemingly came out in this one triggering event, was that someone had gone into the Russian Triangle, like the strangeness, and like there's all these crazy stories of like UFOs coming down in ponds and things being ejected from it and strange balls of light that are rising into the sky, like these strange purple balls. There's one particular story from October of 1984 where on the banks of this local river, there was a Soviet ufologist who had come to investigate some of the reports of what's going on. And right there, almost like being some type of theatrical display for him, he says he sees this strange, large, purple, sparkling ball rise from the forest and then just, he said, dissolve into the sky. He was so shocked by what he saw that he ran into the forest to find this clearing, much like what was described from Alaska. It was like this clearly defined boundary of where this ball had risen from, but it was like it itself had left this 62-meter diameter space that had just taken everything with it, right? It was this odd space, but everything was burnt. There was this weird effect going on. He took soil samples from it and analyzed them and found out that it had extremely high concentrations of rare chemical elements. In fact, the concentrations in the samples was 30 times that of what is average or normal for that particular area. But the story that really got me was that a guy had said that there was many reports of strange time effects, time dilation and distortion that was going on.
They have a statue of an alien out there. There must be something going
on. There's definitely something. There's a lot of weird stuff. But what he did is he's like, okay, there's something really odd about this space and this weird time effects. And when I say time effects, it's like people will wander into this zone and it'll feel like they've been just, like they get lost for 10 minutes. And they know it's 10 minutes because they check their watch. Like, oh, that was odd. Like they know the area well. You know, there's defined boundaries. There's defined landmarks that they know. But they find themselves lost almost in a fairy-like world. People say that they've, like this is supposed to be, this is a cold location. But they find themselves in green fields and strange spaces, sometimes walking through tunnels of mist that kind of appear. But when they come out, they've been gone for 6 hours, you know, something like that. So this guy, this researcher, he's like, I wonder if a thermos will prevent these time effects from happening. So he takes a stopwatch, he seals it in the thermos and walks into one of these areas. Like he walked into one of these locations that's been known to have strange effects going on. He's like, I went away for 5 hours and 26 minutes. And when I returned and opened the thermos and checked the stopwatch, there was 5 hours and 26 minutes on it.
It must be a translation issue.
I'm done. People like tell me, don't quit. I'm done. I'm finished. I don't want to be. So maybe that's what it was.
Did you come across the story of this guy?
No.
His name's Pavel Merkitov. He was a Soviet journalist and he went to the M Triangle region in the Ural Mountains in Russia in 1989 to investigate. Now, he claims that after he visited this area, he immediately had a bizarre interest and increase in knowledge in astrophysics.
Really?
And anything to do with, science he hadn't necessarily previously studied or had an interest in. All of a sudden, he was consuming it and he became very precise with his information about it. This sudden intellectual enhancement led to his acceptance into the Soviet space program as a cosmonaut, according to the story.
What?
So this guy went in as a regular retardo journalist.
Yeah,
as a, just an average journalist, came out a cosmonaut, according to the story.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, some of the allegations in this particular area is because it's not too far as well, some of the phenomenon from the Tunguska meteorite location. So I think it was 400 kilometers. When I say it's not too far in this distance, it's not too far. It's 400 kilometers north of this particular location. But apparently people claim that this area draws in meteorites. Like for whatever reason, because of the electromagnetic effects or something else, it draws things in. Now people claim that there are underground tunnels. And with these underground tunnels, people report that they've encountered what appears to be intelligent ball lightning. Ball lightning itself already behaves in a fashion that suggests that there's an intelligence to it. But what some researchers and eyewitnesses have reported is that they see these ball lightnings following a weird track. And when they've done investigations, they've found that the track corresponds to the tunnels that are underneath. So it's like it's following the line of the tunnel, which is in itself strange. There was one report of a meteorite that fell in this particular area. It fell into the Taiga, which is this, you know, forest area. But it created this hole in the ground. And this hole caused like heat and intense smoke to come pouring out of it for a long period of time. But it in itself caused the local terrain to acquire anomalous properties. They said that the trees around it were all charged, that things became magnetized, seemingly from whatever this effect was of this meteorite coming down the area. Now, is that normal? Can that happen? Or is it that this particular location enhanced the effect of what was going on?
Definitely some weird stories there. There was one from this site over at RussianTimes.com. Apparently, a lot of this started when a geologist went there in the 1980s. His name was Emil Bakhrin, and he was researching the Taiga Forest. But while he was out there, he saw these strange blue light flashes.
Right, yep.
In the forest. He spent the night, camping in the taiga. But then the next morning, he went to where he saw these flashes, and apparently there was a large circle printed in the snow. And so I'm just kind of scanning through this article, and you get a sense it's almost like, what's that place? It's almost like a Sedona type place in Russia where people are going to get healed. See, there's a guy here in the image. He's under this tree, which is supposedly a place of power. So people go there to get healed and have their depression cured, their Russian depression cured. And there's another, this woman here is claiming she was cured by a pine tree out there. Like she was paralyzed and they just...
It says here, there is a 100-year-old pine tree and I was healed at this pine tree. My husband took me there. Have you been healed by a pine? Yes, I was healed by a pine tree. I couldn't walk, lost my memory. Neither my arms nor legs worked. They just took me there on a stool. Doctors didn't help. They wanted to put me in a mental hospital.
That's the most Russian thing ever.
That's very,
like,
very
you're
Russian.
Fully paralyzed, close to death. They're like, here, sit under tree. You'll be fine.
So then you've got an area there, and it changes in its translation. Like, it's referred to as, like, the devil's place, but commonly known as the Devil's Meadow is probably the best way to describe it. It's got a history of strange activity going back to the 1920s, but apparently over a long period of time, this is where close to where one of these meteorites had come down, right? Apparently, people claim that when they go there, it's full of the bones of dead animals, but they themselves feel pain all over their bodies. Apparently, their teeth ache, their joints ache, their heads hurt. When you approach this clearing, the pain actually increases and it causes an irrational feeling of fear within them whenever they tried to get close to it. For years, people avoided this area, but when villagers tried to go back there, once again, they were overcome by body aches and terrible fear. There were some cows that apparently were subjected to some weird activity there. When they tried to recover the cows, they themselves were exposed to this strange effect, and the meat of the animals was in a highly unusual bright red color, which is not what it should be. There was an expedition conducted into the Devil's Meadow in the 1990s, led by a group of UFO researchers. One was Alexander Rempel. They claimed that when they went into this area, the properties of the glade began to change. They encountered an overgrowth of grass. They also claimed that, once again, it caused fear and pain. Dogs ran into the clearing, behaved in a highly strange fashion, and seemingly were exhausted. They refused to eat for quite a long period afterwards. Very, very odd effects that are occurring in this location.
I think we should go there. One last road trip.
Well, yeah, and then we get dashed into another dimension.
Oh, we get healed under the pine.
Yeah, okay, all right.
So like then, 48-hour live stream sitting under the pine tree.
Yeah, because that's compelling, compelling content there. Oh, they're all paranormal whores anyway. It's fine. Late autumn of 2012, you got Peter Pavlovich. He was a physics teacher at a local secondary school. He was cleaning corn in his garden, sitting on a stool, when on this cloudless day, with the temperature being around 8 degrees, something distracted him. He said about 15 meters away was an adult man of average height, just who appeared out of nowhere. This is just on the outskirts of this particular M zone, not right in it, but on the outskirts. He was dressed in a black sweatshirt and rubber boots. The details that he perceived and not remembered very well, but he said the face was of a person who was not from here. The man silently moved parallel to the observer. Apparently, he tried to greet him because this was customary to do so in the town, but he said he couldn't. And this creature looked more like a robot as he moved silently along. After walking another 10 or 15 steps, the man very quickly disappeared into a greenish, misty haze. The teacher noted the color of the fog, and he said this was very unusual because everything around him was just a normal autumn grayscape. He said he wasn't sure what happened, but this vision lasted for around 15 seconds. He said he went home or went inside and for whatever reason felt like he should tell his eldest son. His eldest son was like, oh, yeah, where you were there? Previously, I'd seen a horse-drawn chariot just appear out of nowhere and also disappear into that space.
Okay.
So it's like, okay, there's other strange activity that's associated here. But a whole collection of this kind of stuff, very poorly translated on this UFO.ru website, but I'll link to it in the show notes so you can go and check it out for yourself.
Yeah, there's a bunch of Russian documentaries. Here's Vadim Chernobrov, you know, that famous UFO researcher, showing the entities from the region.
Yeah, it's weird. There's a lot of strange stuff that occurs here. But of course, because it's all kind of in a different language, it doesn't really come through very well. People aren't that familiar with it. There's one other report I want to include here, though. So this is from, I don't know the riverbank it is, but there's two eyewitnesses.
Still in Russia.
Still in Russia.
Still in this zone.
Still in the outskirts of this zone and this one. Apparently, there was a couple that had decided to go for an evening walk when their attention was drawn by something that was rather unusual. They said that they came close to a building. They thought it was like a huge hill or bumps on top. When they got closer, they realized it was a building of perfect semicircular shape. Apparently, it had small domes built onto each arch. There was an entrance that was clearly visible, but not any doors. But when they came closer, they seemingly passed through it, these solid stone doors. They went inside the structure and found that it was this place that was kind of odd. There was like green all through the inside. It was grass, bushes, trees, but they were overcome by a strange fear. So they tried to flee and they were able to move from the outside. Well, they moved from the outside of it. They claimed that there were weird structures depicting goddesses and grey stone on the inside. They were made of some strange pink granite, much like the story I was only telling earlier of people passing into that realm of where they were able to see granite stone figurines inside. I mean, that was supposedly in the astral realm, and yet you've got people that are going into these zones claiming that they're encountering these odd structures. Now, when they fled, much like a time slip in the daylight, they tried to go back. Of course, it's not there. There's nothing there. It's like, if it was just a singular individual, you can go, well, that person's clearly having some type of hallucination or a breakdown. But when it's two people that are swearing they're seeing the same thing in an area that is connected with a lot of high strangeness, you have to start questioning, are people heading into another realm? Is that what's going on here? Is this where people are disappearing to? And simply, you know, we don't have the reports of what happened to them because they never come back. It's really as simple as that. But then I want to describe, just quickly before we go ahead, some of the dangers. And look, we've got a little bit of time to describe this. People have described strange things of like going into these zones, and this is the Russian zone, of encountering strange balls of light that morph and change into humanoid figures. I think that was similar to what you were describing or showing on the screen there before, Ben, of people encountering these humanoids that are in this area. Well, it has a fey folklore kind of feeling about it, right? It's got this weird, you know, people in the 1800s, 1700s, even earlier would describe this as being fairies. They're being pixie-led because of what's happening. People are getting lost. They're getting disoriented. People are encountering strange beings. They're having time slips. All of this stuff is consistent with, you know, folkloric legends. Well, then we go back to Oxfordshire, right? This was reported in the fairy census. And this comes from a place known as the Bluebell Woods. Now, apparently, in this particular area, the witness was looking at this scene. And this scene was of bluebells, like flowers, all across this carpet of these flowers. They were camping. But when they were looking into this field of these flowers, the witness and other campers noticed a large number of small blue orbs rising from the field. Like these orbs started kind of moving like fireflies, if you will, but blue, moving about. Now, as these balls were moving about, the witness felt this unusual silence, which we know, of course, is the Oz effect, and a sudden chill. It changed the physical properties of the area. Now, these lights, possibly hundreds of them, danced around forming beautiful patterns in the sky, but when it was around 75 feet away, these lights came together and coalesced into a humanoid form. This thing just started walking about, but it like made up of all these blue balls that were glittering and moving about. The form itself turned its head to look at the witnesses before dematerializing and flying away, or deforming, I'm sorry, and then flying away over the flower field. Like, these reports are very similar. This is from, you know, the fairy sense. This is in the UK, but you've got these reports that parallel from Russia. Is everyone making it up? Is everyone having weird hallucinations? Or is it that this is a phenomenon which is consistent throughout the world? Whether we're talking about the Bermuda Triangle or the Mexican Zone of Silence or the Alaska Triangle or this Russian Zone, are these areas where people are able to pass into other dimensions and they see the inhabitants of these other realms, these other dimensions? And I think that's more likely. I think that's what's going on. And don't get me wrong, it can happen in more regular locations, I suppose you could call them. It doesn't necessarily always have to be, you know, in one of these zones, but it seems like we have a higher concentration of the phenomena in these zones.
Yeah, there seems to be certain places in the earth where you can access the layers of existence, because there certainly is layers.
That's right. Yeah,
we see our material dimension, but human beings are composed of multiple aspects, some of them not material.
And then, you know, I was also thinking about this anecdote that I came across that was reported by Malcolm Smith over at Malcolm's Anomalies. And I thought this is fascinating because it's consistent with what people describe in that they run into beings, right? But in just its odd circumstances, there's nothing especially supernatural or, you know, that can be said to be you encountering beings from other realms. But there are so many of these reports of people just encountering strange people, like these three people that are hanging about wearing silver clothing in the Mexico Zone of Silence. You have these outliers. So there's this story that Malcolm writes comes from an old issue of MUFON Journal. It was the issue number 436 from August of 2004. And it comes from a story from a couple from Alaska. All right, so we come full circle. We come back to the Alaskan Triangle. So it writes that an unusual event reportedly occurred in Alaska within the 1949 to 1951 time period. A couple, naked and covered in dirt or dust, came to the door of Victoria's mother's home. They asked if they could bathe. The mother reluctantly agreed to this. Now, before they left, she gave them clothes. When she cleaned out the bathtub, her hands went numb. She said nothing would help. Suddenly, there was a knock on the door. She found a very tall man, much like the ones that are coming out of Mexico, standing there holding a tube of salve. He tore it in half and gave one half to her, telling her that it would take care of her problem with her hands. It did. She saved the remainder of the salve for years, wrapping it in a handkerchief. It dried to a pink powder. She gave a sample of this to Bill Jones at a MUFON symposium in July of 2003, and it was submitted for analysis. A Dr. Bundinger apparently did an analysis. He said it contained glycerol and glycerides, but also calcium bentonite, which apparently is an absorbent clay with a variety of uses, including treatment of skin irritations. Now, let's break this down for a second.
Yeah, what is going on?
You've got a naked, dirty couple that just seem to be odd knocking on the door of a random home in Alaska. I don't know if this is in the triangle, but I'm wondering, we've just been talking about this. They asked to bathe and they bathe. Now, when she cleans out the bathtub, her hands go numb.
Yeah, okay, stop there. Why would your hands go numb?
That's exactly right. Unless there's some substance. But I would say it's because these beings, like if they're not temporarily like in the right, so is that what there's like something left over? Is there some type of like a temporal residue that's what's causing her hands to go numb? Like it's causing her to be out of phase? But why would they show, like bathe in a river? Like it's all, like it's
pretty
orchestrated.
Cold. It's pretty cold.
It is cold, right? But then the fact that she's like, oh, my hands are numb and nothing is, and there's just suddenly a knock at the door
from
this tall freak. That
salve ready to go.
Has this weird substance ready to go and it's analyzed and it turns into a weird pink powder. None of this makes sense, but I think that's part of it, right? We're not meant to make sense of what this stuff
is.
He
says at the end, my guess is that the couple were human guinea pigs in some strange experiment, and the experimenter realized that if the housewife's numbness was not treated, the story was likely to go public.
Yeah. That comes back to my suspicion that on some level, these beings know more about us clearly than we know about them. And they don't want us to know about what they're doing and why they're doing it.
He's saying it could be a government, some kind of government experiment.
Maybe, but the high strangeness attached to it, like it just, the guy right at the moment where she's thinking, oh, my hands are weird. Like,
and he's oddly tall.
Yeah, which is consistent with these other reports. And then, of course, Malcolm brings up this other article, which I just thought was fascinating because it shows you that like it's consistent with what people are reporting in these zones. So in these zones, there are these fae folkloric style experiences where people are engulfed by weird balls of light. If you recall that weird story I told you many years ago, Ben, from, was it Australia? It was where someone was looking outside their property, looking out their window, and this area was also associated with weird activity. And they saw this weird ball of light pursue a hiker who was running down this path, and the ball of light engulfed them and the person just disappeared. Remember that story? Like,
vaguely, yeah.
Weird. Like, really, really weird.
Also, now a crime.
Yeah, of course, yeah. So there's this story from November of 1979. It's just northwest of Paris. And this Frank Fontaine, he was 19. He was sitting in a station wagon. He'd loaded it with clothes for a local market. He'd taken a couple of friends with him. Now, as they're driving along, heading towards the market, they see this long, opaque trail of white lights similar to stars, but it definitely wasn't stars. And for whatever reason, Fontaine just blurts out to his fellow passengers, "I'm going there. I want to know." And that's just kind of odd. They rushed home. Apparently, they pulled over. The two colleagues or the two passengers rushed home because they weren't too far to go and grab the camera. When they got back, they found the car 200 meters down the road surrounded by a halo of light in a thick fog. There were three or four small spheres lit up moving about the inside of the vehicle, and their friend was nowhere to be seen. The luminous mist then shot up towards the sky, and their friend vanished literally off the face of the earth. Much like many of these reports of people being engulfed by something, taken, like he's gone. Now, again, remember, 26th of November, this was 4:30 a.m. on the 3rd of December, right? So days later, 1979, Fontaine appears at the spot where he disappeared.
What?
He wasn't hungry, he wasn't thirsty, and he had no idea that seven whole days had disappeared. He didn't even think minutes had disappeared. All he remembers is moving along in the car. It stopped. He noticed this weird luminous ball to his right that grew larger and larger before it engulfed the vehicle, causing some irritation to his eyes, and then that was it. By the way, the station wagon, gone. He just reappears, the vehicle gone.
That's the best scenario for these missing people. They just turn up again in 2036
That's
or something.
Right. Yeah. So he goes and
then
knocks.
Then the asteroid comes.
Yeah. He goes and knocks on, well, yeah, like 10 minutes before. He's like, "Hey, I've got to tell you, by the way, we're about to be wiped out by an asteroid." He goes and knocks on the door of his friend. His friend obviously is shocked to find him, but he's still in the same uncrumpled clothes. Like, his clothing is no mud on his shoes or his clothes. He's carrying the same amount of money. So it wasn't a robbery. Not that robbers, you know, remove people in light, although they did steal his car, so maybe. But what was really bizarre, much like some of these stories of time slips and time distortions we've heard before, is that he was completely clean shaven. Like, he'd left.
So you mean he didn't have a 5 o'clock shadow?
No, 5 o'clock shadow.
No beard, yeah.
So either he had to go somewhere and shave in those 7 days, but no one knew where he was, or he just simply had some weird time distortion. He'd passed through something. Very, very strange reports. I don't know what to make of them. But it's consistent with this kind of stuff that there are a collection of these things. And I will go into later on, I'm realizing I'm running short here, running out of time, but there is also the pocket dimension. And what this is, right, it comes really full scale, or full circle, I'm sorry, in the sense that if these beings in these zones know about humanity and they know how to interfere with us and they know how to manipulate us, I think is the way to describe it. What they do is they take people into the pocket zone. They generate areas that they can mess with people, much like the story of Diane, who they tapped into her fear. Like, she passed into this space, right? For her, it was this clearing. And in this clearing, there was no sound. And then she had these horrible events take place. But after the events had taken place and she was back on the path, there was no zone. It had completely disappeared. It's like the story of the woodcutter or the woodcutter's daughter, who, again, in a fae folk tale, she had gone out looking for firewood to assist her father. She fell into some weird space, some weird clear space that she was in this ditch, and people were looking for her. And she could see the woodcutter and other people of villagers coming searching for her. She's bashing on the side of that, this weird force field. No one can see her, even though the fact that they're right there, feet from her, until finally it dissipates and she's able to come back. And she's been missing for days. Mm. Although for her, it only feels like, you know, a matter of hours. This kind of stuff is repetitive. It goes on and on and on. So I'm wondering if that's what's going on. They're generating these pocket dimensions to mess with humanity. But for what purposes? You know, the mind boggles.
Yeah, it's an interesting concept. Coming up in the Plus extension, I'm going to be looking into encounters of parallel worlds. Again, from a Russian perspective, some very similar stories. Like, one, for example, just comes to mind. There's a woman, she goes out with her husband and they're picking mushrooms in their favorite forest. Mm. But she sees this beautiful glade. And there's mushrooms everywhere, like her favorite kind of mushrooms. So she goes in and starts picking them. And her husband yells out eventually, you know, "Margaret, where are you?" And she says, "Oh, I'm here. I'll be up a few minutes." And she eventually fills her basket. It takes like 2 minutes.
Yeah, nothing.
She leaves the glade and he's like sweating.
Yeah.
Like freaking out. He's like, "Where have you been? It's been 2 hours.
Hours. Yeah, it's amazing just how recurrent those particular types of stories are, where it's like someone, and again, it's got this missing 411 theme to it, where they've gone just into a wilderness area to where the, you know, like a guy's walking along and his wife is like, oh, look at that beautiful bird's nest. And she just steps back for 2 seconds and he turns around and she's gone. Now for her, she just simply looks at the bird's nest. Hey, that's cool. Goes back to the path. The husband's freaked out because she's been missing for hours. Like this, repeated over and over again, just truly bizarre, strange stories.
Well, that brings us to the end of our free show, but there's a lot more coming up on this podcast. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus and you'll see the plus membership we have. It's only $9 a month, gets you access to the plus subscription where we do an exclusive extension on the end of these shows every single Friday. And of course, exclusive shows every single Tuesday as well. Make sure you sign up for Plus. All the videos are on the website as well. Plus, you get a higher quality MP3 version of the show and totally ad-free versions of the show as well. If you sign up for the MU Max tier, you get access to our massive, massive back catalog going back 16 plus years worth of shows. So check it out, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. If you're on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. For everyone else, we'll see you next week. Welcome back to your Plus extension. Great to have you.